Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
You're listening to Griefcast with me, Cariad Lloyd. Griefcast is a place to talk, share and laugh about the peculiar human process of death and grief. Each week, I talk to a different person about their experiences of grief and death as we remember someone that they have lost along the way, whether it was a long time ago or you've just joined the club. Welcome to Griefcast.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-.
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, Griefsters. I hope you're having an okay week. As you can hear, I have a stinking cold, as I like to call it, because I have children who go to nursery. And so, therefore, I am susceptible to picking up the crap that they bring home with them. I hope wherever you are, you're doing okay. It's a very strange time we are living through. And if you are trying to deal with your own grief at the moment, it's quite a lot. So I'm just sending you love and thinking of you. And thank you so much for all of your wonderful messages about last week's episode and all this series. I've really appreciated it. If you have enjoyed the show, if I say it husky, is it going to work? Please do rate, review and subscribe. You're listening to Radio 4. No, you're not. You're listening to The Griefcast and I'm very grateful that you are. This week, I'm talking to journalist and writer Natalie Morris. Natalie is the author of a brilliant new book, came out very recently, Mixed Other, Explorations of Multiraciality in Modern Britain. Just came out, it's excellent. Natalie came in to talk to me about her dad, who died of cancer in the summer of 2020. So Natalie, who are we remembering today?
We are remembering our dad, Tony Morris. And I say our dad because me and my little sister, Becky, are like intricately in this together. I find it weird saying my dad or I lost my dad because I'm like, that doesn't sound right in my mouth when I say it. So I always say our dad, which is weird when people don't have context because they're just like, who are you referring to? Is this like the royal we? And I'm like, no, it's me and my sister. We lost our dad, Tony Morris, the most wonderful man and dad you could ask for. And that was in August 2020.
So really recent, like you're sort of, you're heading towards your year anniversary, but yeah, that's still very, very fresh. So what did he die of? What happened?
So he had kidney cancer for a very short amount of time. It was all very fast and unexpected. And I think we're all still quite in shock as to how this even has happened and how this is our new reality. But he didn't tell us in classic dad style that it was cancer initially. So in December 2019, I got a phone call at work from him, not unusual. He'd always just call me at random points in the day and I would do my best to answer. And I was stood in the corridor and he told me that they'd found a cyst in his kidney. And I was like, okay, that's manageable.
Sure. Right,
like, okay, like fine. They're like, he said, it's a big cyst. We have to take the whole kidney out. And he sounded quite edgy. And I was just like, okay, like I know people who only have one kidney. Like this is okay. Modern medicine. Well, this is fine. Like we can work with this. This is okay. So I hung up and I was like, he sounded really edgy about that. And I was like, I'm not really understanding where that stress is coming from. I was like, have I missed something? And so I said to my boss, like, I live in London and my dad's was in North Manchester. So I was like, I need to go home and just to be with him, because I was just thinking he was maybe scared about the procedure, about having major surgery. He was really, really active and like sport was his whole life. And I think I was like, maybe he's nervous about, you know, being out of action for a while after the surgery. Mm. So, and he lived on his own in Ramsbottom, which is this ridiculous village in Bury. And it's like just hilly and like nothing there but like sheep. And I was like, okay, I'm going to go hang out with him. So I took a week off work and went up just after he'd had his surgery, and he was fine. Like, he was, you know, obviously on painkillers and, you know, a bit struggling with some of his movement, but overall seemed completely fine. And I was like, okay, great, this is good. And I just wanted to be there to, you know, to cook his food and do his shopping and just hang out with him, really, because I didn't want him to be lonely or worried or stressed out. And it was such a nice week. Like, that was the longest amount of extended time that the two of us have spent together under the same roof since I was like a child. Like, we hung out obviously a lot for weekends, but to have a whole week in his house just watching movies and hanging out was just really lovely. But that first night I got there, he'd ordered a Chinese and we were chatting, and I was like, how did the surgery go? What did the surgeon say? Mm. And he said, yeah, so they said they got the whole tumor out. And I was like, they got the what? And then
it's such a different, like, you're right, cyst has this kind of like, yeah, cyst, like tumor benign, is like alarm bells. Like,
yeah, like total alarm bells. And I was like, what is happening? And he just looked at me and just gave me this look, this classic, like, oh yeah, you've caught me out here. And I was like, what is this? And he was like, yeah, it was a cancerous tumor. But then very quickly followed it up with, but they got it out. It was localized in the kidney. Everything's fine. And I just burst into tears, which is very not me. But I just started crying into like my sweet and sour chicken. And he was just like, you see, this is why I didn't tell you. This is why. And I was like, well, can you give me a minute? Like, okay,
to
I'm just
process
digesting.
What's happened. Yeah.
So he told me that. I started crying, then composed myself. And he, you know, and I was like, okay, they said they got it all. But there was, I think in that moment, I knew, or I decided that was what was going to get him at some point. My brain just spiraled ahead, and I have this quite morbid, I guess, pessimistic view of illness and health and stuff. And, you know, I've seen it with friends, I've seen it with friends' parents. You get cancer and eventually it comes back. And I was just immediately in that moment like, okay, if it's not imminently, then in 5 years, 10 years, this is what's going to get you. And I just remember thinking that so clearly. But in that moment, he was convinced it was all fine. Everything was fine. He was having another scan in 3 months to see how things were. And so I just pushed it to the back of my mind and was like, he's fine. He seems fine. Look at him. He's fine. Like, he was okay. I went back to London. The pandemic hit. That was a treat.
Yeah. So you've just, so that was December. And then obviously, March, we all going to lockdown. So you've kind of spent that time with him. But so he was having to sort of, was his treatment paused or was it kind of?
So he wasn't on treatment at this point.
Right.
Because he was, they thought they'd got it.
Right.
So he then went and had a scan, and that's when he called to say they had not got it and it was in other places. Because another thing that he failed to mention was that it was actually a very aggressive and fast spreading form of cancer, which is something he just conveniently left out when he told me about the tumour. And from then on, it was just very, very rapid. And they tried immunotherapy. Luckily, nothing was paused because he'd already had his surgery. So the treatment was able to continue. But the treatment just didn't work, essentially. And he just got worse really quickly.
And was he in Manchester at this point? And you were in London. So how were you sort of coping with that lockdown? I'm not supposed to go and see him. Like, that must be really difficult, right?
It was so difficult.
Yeah.
But at the same time, early on, we all thought it was going to be fine. We thought he was on immunotherapy. He was 57, incredibly healthy, in incredible shape, doing so much sport. and we just thought, well, he'll be fine, like, because people are fine now. Sometimes people are fine with cancer now. And we thought the treatment would work. But he kept getting pains. He kept having to go to hospital. The pain wasn't being managed. And it just kept getting worse. And he kept putting it down to different things. And eventually, one time when he was admitted to hospital for the pain, they finally did a scan and found that it had spread more because it was very aggressive and the immunotherapy wasn't working. And that's when he texted me, my mum and my sister, because I don't think he could face doing the 3 phone calls that he needed to do. And I'd sat down at my desk and was just about to start working from home to do my little shift at work. And I got this text that said, yeah, it's the immunotherapy is not working. It's not good news. And he said the doctor had put his hand on his shoulder. And he said that was the moment where he was just like, oh, shit, basically. Mm. And that was that day. I didn't do my shift. I just crawled back into bed where my boyfriend was and just like sobbed on him and decided that I needed to come home. My wonderful friend Donna was driving up north that weekend and drove me home because we weren't sure about the train situation and what was allowed and what wasn't. And I was just like, I have to get home right now. And that's what I did.
Oh, bless you. That is a lot. So, and then was that kind of August time or July by the time it's, well?
So that was end of June, I think, right, when I decided to come home because I was at home, or mid-June, because I was at home for 6 weeks before he actually died. And half of that time he was in a hospice. Right. So there were 3 weeks where it was just getting worse and worse and no one could get a handle on it. And it felt like the doctors were just chasing it. They couldn't keep up. And this whole process has really shown me how little control these people have. And you think, when you've not experienced it like this, you think, okay, well, they know what to do and they've got answers for most things. And then you realise how reactive so much of this is and how much they're reacting to what an individual person's body decides to do.
There was an episode with Sophie Black, who's a brilliant podcaster, broadcaster, and her mum died of lung cancer, and she was saying she went to see the consultant afterwards, and the consultant, you know, she was trying to say why, you know, what happened, and the consultant described human bodies like a spider web, you know, like you're kind of like one thing goes and you might be looking there, but actually you haven't realized quite how many other things are affected by that. And that really stayed with me because I was like, we don't think of human bodies like that. We sort of think of them as like straight lines. And they're not really, really complicated. And it sounds similar, really similar to my dad, which, you know, doesn't often happen on the show because I speak to so many different people, but I can really relate to that. Like, but why aren't you fixing it? Like, he's healthy, he's young. Why aren't we just getting the, oh, he's had treatment speech and he's okay? Like, and you said you sort of reached this, which I think must be hard for doctors because they never came out and were like, we can solve everything. But that's what you think. That's what you think. And then when you're faced with someone who can't, it's like you said, they're just chasing. They're just chasing something that's slowly killing someone. It's a really strange thing, isn't it? To sort of dawn on you of like, oh, right, I see. It's not. We're the 21st century, but we're also.
Completely. It's shaken my whole foundation of understanding and you know, how little control we have over so many things. But particularly on this medical side, and one thing they said to me that really made a lot of sense and I'd never thought about it before was that often in younger, healthier cancer patients, they kind of trick you because their bodies are really strong and healthy. So you don't realise how bad it is often until it's too late. So if it had happened, and this is what the consultant told me when I had a similar phone call being like, can someone tell me what happened here? And they said, well, we didn't know that it was basically going to fall off a cliff at a certain point because he'd been coping because his body was strong. Whereas if he'd been maybe in his 80s or overweight or more frail or had all the different health conditions, he might have been iller faster that for all of us to see, you know.
It sucks so much because that's exactly what they said with my dad. They were like,
really?
Because he was 44 and he was very, very sporty, training for an Ironman, run marathons, run triathlons, and they said, well, if he was in his 80s it wouldn't have spread so fast because his metabolism was so fast and he was so healthy that the moment it got into his pancreas, it just like boom, went everywhere. Yeah. And yeah, again, you're like, all right. Right, that's interesting information, isn't it? Because my whole life has been about be healthy, be fit, be this. And you're like, and yet here you're holding this up as the reason that they died quickly.
Honestly,
and it's so hard to get
injustice.
Your head around. It's really weird, isn't it? It's really weird when, somebody who's fit and healthy. And I think that that really leads to, I'm sure we'll talk about, so much shock. And I don't know if you had this, like, his community of friends and family were so shocked, like, not him, not him. He's the healthy one. He's not the one that is drinking red wine and overweight and, you know, like, you've got to be careful. And that, I think, shocks people to the core that, oh, shit, anyone can get cancer.
Like, completely. Yeah, it's really destabilizing thing. Like, it's against the order of, like, what's supposed to happen. And like you say, that being told that, the fact that he's healthy and strong contributed to this like shock of nobody knowing how bad it was. It's just like, that's not how it's supposed to work. That's completely opposite to what we've been told. So that was really hard to get my head around.
God, yeah. I found that stuck with me for years. Just like,
yeah,
wow. And then you will probably experience this. So if I tell people, oh, he was 44, and they go, oh, did he smoke? Because they're like, they want something. And I'll be like, he did, but when he was younger. Oh. And I'll be like, he was very fit and very healthy. And you can see they're like, what? Like, they want the negative narrative to go, okay, I'm going to be all right, or I feel better. Like, you know, I don't do those things. And because we would all love to believe that if you're fit and healthy, you're somehow magically protected. But it's not always the case. So he was in the hospice as you come to August. Were you with him when he died? What happened there?
Yes, we were, my sister and I. So it was, those 3 weeks of him being in the hospice, I feel like I have very much like walled them up inside me. Mm. And that's kind of my current coping mechanism. But it was nothing short of traumatic, really, the whole experience. You know, I was trying to work at the same time because we didn't know how long it was going on for. And I'm like, well, before all of this, I was very much conscientious to a fault, and I was like, I can't let people see that I'm having a hard time, or that I can't do everything. Of course I can do everything, I can do it all. So I was getting up at like 6 a.m. trying to do like 6 hours of work, and then I would go to the hospice and spend however many hours with Dad that day that he was up for. We never knew how that was going to go, how he would be. It was really changeable day by day, and it seemed to go up and down, and there were points in those 3 weeks where I was like, oh, this is it. And then it wasn't. And we'd be like, oh, okay, maybe, oh, this is okay. Like, okay, we're watching a movie today, this is fine. And then another day, and you just don't know. And it was like bone tiring. Like, I've never been exhausted like that in my whole life. We would literally crawl home from the hospice and just like sit on the sofa, and it'd be like 7 p.m. and I'd be looking at my mum like, should we just go to bed? Like, and it was, I've never been so exhausted ever. But it was really, really quick. And some days were really nice in the hospice, which is weird. And we were just really normal and just taking the piss out of each other and chatting and playing Mario Karts and watching movies and drinking sneaky vodka and coke at like, 11 a.m. and hiding it from the nurses and playing tunes, like all the stuff that we just did, the three of us. Often it was very like that, and sometimes you'd forget where you were or what was happening, and you were like, it was only really when you step out of that you can look at the weirdness of that situation. I felt like I regressed because I don't have a car, and neither does my sister, so we were very much, you know, we were dependent on our mum to like give us lifts to the hospice every day or like get an Uber, and it was just like, what are we doing? This is so weird. And it was the opposite side of Manchester, so just every day we were slogging across Manchester there and back. It was so weird. And I keep remembering we'd play the radio all the way there and all the way back, and there's all these like weird pop songs, like Ariana Grande, Rain On Me, was playing all the time. And now every time I hear that song, I'm just like, oh, like makes me go cold. And I'm like, but hospices are just I didn't know they were a thing.
Weird, right? I mean, you don't need to be honest, until someone's like, they're going into and you're like, oh, okay, fine. Yeah, they kind of is a real, it's a magical thing that we have them. Do you know what I mean? That there's a place people go to die. Like, and I think people just don't, we use the word hospice as such a blanket, like, oh, hospice, hospice, sounds like hospital. Yeah. Like, yeah, okay, I sort of know what that means. But when you, you know, have to go into one and you see those people who literally is, you know, like, it's like, I talk about this a lot, but it's like when you go into like a birthing unit and like everyone in there is only about bringing life into the world. And it has a weird energy of like, wow, this place is like, this is baby city. When you go to a hospice, you're like, oh, this is death city. This is where everyone goes to leave. Like, it's really strange.
So strange. And I feel very lucky and privileged that I got to 31 without having to really know what a hospice was. But oh my gosh, they're amazing places. And the women who worked there, they were all women, the nurses at Berry Hospice. Unbelievable. They are angels on this earth. Like, I am forever in their debt and utter gratitude at the grace and dignity they afforded my dad, and the support they gave to me and my sister, and just the way they treated him was just amazing. And he was like, the room he was in was just beautiful, and he had this view of the garden, and they made sure he got to go outside and look at it, and just these tiny little touches that just I'm so forever grateful that they that people do that for people in that part of their life. And I think it's unbelievable that we have that, and I think we have to protect it at all costs. Like, I get so worried, you know, when we hear about the NHS and the cuts, and I just think we cannot cut that. Having seen that,
I know.
The alternative, I'm just like, we have to continue to have that, because...
Yeah, and it's one of those things, you know, like a good birthing unit, it's not until you really need it that you think, oh my God, like, what would I do if this wasn't here? Like, and I think, hospices and, you know, and the NHS, and, you know, obviously it has its faults and it's a huge, huge institution, but like, the dignity that, like you said, people who work in the hospice industry, I suppose, the difference they make to someone's grief and someone's death is huge, isn't it? I find it mind-blowing. You know, like, if you're a writer and you have a bad day, you're like, well, I had a bad day. But if you're like, you're like, God, every day must have to be a good day, because you're like, you're helping people die. This is so important. Your job's so important.
Yeah.
So you and your sister were with him when he died.
Yes. It was funny because his room had been completely inundated with gifts. So he had like a million bottles of whiskey. And I was like, why? Like, what's he going to do with that? I was like, why don't people stop sending him giant bottles of booze? But there was bottles of booze everywhere, cards everywhere, sweets, chocolate, like books, everything. And it was like flowers. It was ridiculous. And we came in on that day, the Friday. It was like ridiculously hot. It was a heat wave. It was really sunny. Which is like some weird, like, opposite pathetic fallacy. I was like, this does not suit what's happening. It's so incongruous. I don't like this. It's weird. And we went into the room, and it was funny because there was only really, in all those ups and downs, there was only really one day where I really saw him struggling. And I was like, oh my God, I can't like see him like this. And it was really, really hard to see that. And he had absolutely had enough at that point. But I look back and I'm like, that was awful. But I'm also so grateful that was only one day of that like agitation, you know, when someone's like not happy and there was nothing we could do. Me and my sister were like, we are like so helpless, you know, and you're just so, it's completely helpless. And that was the worst feeling. And then so the next day when we came in, and I've been holding on to the hope that it had just been another dip, and that we'd come back and he'd have bounced back up again, and we'd be putting like Toy Story or Pulp Fiction on or something and just chilling. But we got in there and he was not really there, breathing in a weird way. And it was really hard to see that. But what was amazing was that the whole room had been transformed into this like oasis of calm.
Wow.
And that was the first thing I noticed, and like all the presents and all the clutter and everything had gone somewhere. They'd like magicked it away. And there were candles and they had soft music on.
Wow.
And they'd like half shaded the curtain, so the light was just coming in softly as opposed to like being too bright. And it smelled amazing in there. They'd like put some like diffuser, and I was like, whoa, this is, I was like, it's very calm in here. It's very calm. So the nurses must have known and done that, which was, again, amazing. And I've only really thought of that, obviously, subsequently. I wasn't really thinking that in the moment.
No, of course. But it's those like those tiny things that you go back and you're like, hang on, where did all this stuff go?
They went in and did that for him and for us. And like that was just so nice. And he very much waited for us. And I still think about it all the time, because the Friday, the night before, when he'd been agitated, we left at about lunchtime, because I felt like there wasn't much we could do and that our presence wasn't necessarily helping. Because to add to all of this, because of the pandemic, only me and my sister could go and visit him. No one else was allowed in at any point.
Oh my God.
So that was a huge...
That's a huge responsibility
for us. It was like, if he's not with us, then he's alone. But I was like, but I can't.
I can't be there all the time. Yeah, you need those moments of fresh air, and when someone else comes in and changes the atmosphere and the energy, that's so hard.
So it was a lot, and there's been a lot of guilt attached to that. Which I think there wouldn't have been if we'd have been able to share that across his many, many friends and our mum and other family members who were desperate to be there as well. Like, my poor mum had to drive us to the hospice, sit in the car park for who knows how long, sometimes 3 hours, sometimes 6 hours, wait for us. And she didn't know what we would be like when we came out, because some days it was okay. Other days we'd come out just distraught.
God.
And my mum tried to come and see him at the window. And the poor nurses had to go and be like, you can't, like, you have to go. And they were heartbroken, because they were like, this isn't what we want it to be like here. This isn't what we're about. They love, and, you know, it was just,
That's so hard, Natalie. That's so hard. That is so hard. Because, like, having been in that situation where everyone's allowed in and it's a revolving door, and obviously, you know, people get overwhelmed and you don't want everybody in, but I remember those last few weeks of like random people turning up and going into the room being like, oh right, he's with some colleague friend who knew him, they're chatting, and then me and my brother would like go and have a disgusting hospital like spaghetti hoops on toast or something, then come back and just that feeling of like, oh, the world is kind of coming to say goodbye. And that's what this past year, like, it's such a small thing, you know, and when you put things on paper, it's like, well, okay, no one's allowed to visit, but children allowed to visit. Well, therefore, we've covered it. But actually, like, that is a lot to carry. That load should be shared by the community of people. He wasn't just a dad. He was, you know, a husband at one point, and a friend, and, you know, cousin, and all these things. Like, there's other roles that have to be honoured. That's so hard for you guys. So hard.
I know. And I think about his friends and how hard this must be for him, for them, knowing that he just... was, because also it was so quick, there was so little preparation. Like, he was literally in work like a few weeks before he went, like 2 weeks before he went to the hospice.
Oh my God.
So for them to see him in the office and then a few weeks later he's gone into a hospice and then they never see him again, like, how do people process that?
It's really hard.
So we left on the Friday when he was agitated, because we were like, I think he maybe needs to sleep, or he needs some more painkillers, or there's something he needs that we can't give to him. At the same time, he was very much wanting to continue to be our dad at all points. And that's why he was adamant about being in the hospice, not being at home. We were, because at certain points we were like, well, you know, we'll take you to my mum's and we'll look after you. And he was like, absolutely not. Like, no, like, you are my kids and that's what I want you to be. And I knew it was hard for him sometimes when we were there, seeing him in pain or uncomfortable. So I was like, we're going to go. And as we left on the Friday, he like gave me this look, and he couldn't really speak on that day because, I don't know, the painkillers or the drugs that he was on, he wasn't able to talk. But he just looked at me and was kind of like frowning, or confused. And I remember thinking, I was like, tell me what you need, tell me what you need. And he couldn't. And we left. And then the next morning we came and we were only there for about an hour before he died. And I think he very much waited for us to get there because obviously he'd had the whole night, he'd had the morning. We got there as soon as they opened at like 8, or as soon as visiting time opened. And it wasn't like it is in the films. It was it was very weirdly underwhelming. He was very calm, and the whole thing was very calm and peaceful. And we just held his hands and sat either side of him and told him how much we loved him and how amazing he was and how grateful we were for him. And then we told him it was okay if he wanted to go. And then he took his last breaths, but he was like looking directly at us both. And yeah, it seemed peaceful, you know? So that's been a big comfort.
Oh, Natalie. It's really reminded me of my dad. Really similar. Really similar. And there's no logic to any of these things, but of course you put them on your scales, your grief scales, and you're like, well, it was so quick and they were so young, but we were there and we did, like. And I do think that the thing with cancer, not everybody as well, of course, but you do get a bit of time compared to someone, you know, someone who just dropped dead. And if you do get to have that, where they get to be in the hospice or cancer ward and you get to be there, I mean, it's little, it's small, but it's sometimes something. And yeah, I'm just glad that he had that, you know, in these circumstances, that you, both of you were, it wasn't like, oh, one of you can go in or something awful like that.
God.
Like, you know, the fact that you're both able to be there and both tell him that you love him, and he went surrounded by the love that you'd clearly had the whole time he was alive. Like, I don't, that's all you can ask for. Like, you can't really ask for anything else. Yeah.
You literally can't. And I feel like that was our gift to him, and I'm glad we were able to do that for him. Because, you know, if you're going to picture how you're going to go, obviously you're not going to be 57 and full of life a few months before, but if it's inevitable and there's nothing else you can do, you'd want it to be calm, and you'd want to be holding the hands of the people who love you most in the world. So I remember at the time thinking, when those 3 weeks in the hospice, when everything was awful and exhausting, I remember thinking maybe it would be better if we just got a phone call that he'd had a heart attack. And I remember thinking maybe that would be preferable, like, because this is horrific and it felt like too much to bear at times. And it still does. And I think I'm not at the place yet where I feel completely grateful that we had that time.
Oh no, like, because you won't be, like, you're so early. It's so early.
Exactly. And I think, but I also know that I will. I know that that at some point I will be happy, because I've seen other people, friends who've had a phone call about a dad, someone who's had to get on a train then, knowing that this has already happened, knowing they don't get to say goodbye, or a plane or whatever, and get home. And that would have absolutely destroyed me. And, you know, and the amount of guilt you feel just as a griever, that seems to be part of the package for some reason. I just don't think I would have been able to cope with the guilt if I hadn't been there that time before.
Yeah, and, you know, honestly, it wasn't until I started the podcast and I started speaking to not cancer deaths, really. I guess that was a lot of my experience. My dad and then both my my mother-in-law and my father-in-law were cancer as well. And I remember talking to the Mack twins, their episode, their dad had a heart attack, and it really made me go, oh, like, there's no good, is there? Like, but I've also spoken to people who had a very sudden death. You'd be like, oh, you know, God, to have cancer, to have that. And I've been like, well, I'll tell you what, it might sound fun, but because, one is complete shock, and the other one, like you said, is, you get to be there, but the deal is you have to watch them be in agony. And it's like, so there's nobody's winning. Like, nobody is winning.
Yeah.
both things are utterly, utterly painful. But equally, as always with life, both things have things that are not positive, that's the wrong word, but you know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
we got to be there. We got to hold our dad's hands. That is something. That it's small, but it's something. So I am glad, but I totally get, like, you're so at the beginning of this journey, like, it took me years to say anything positive about it. Like, I would have been like, fuck you, Carrie. If I'd been like, oh, well, at least you were there, I'd have been like, what, excuse me? So yeah, I have to remember, like, 23 years in, like, now I'm like, oh yeah, that was good, that was a good thing, I suppose.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Welcome back to Griefcast with Carrie Adloyd. What were the restrictions like for the funeral at that time? Because they've only really just been lifted for funerals, I think.
Well, we weren't at the strictest point then. So, it was mid-August, the funeral, 13th of August, I think. And we were allowed 30 people.
Okay.
But, like, loads of people came outside the church, which was very not COVID-y, but very good for us and... Yeah, it was actually a really beautiful funeral, if that is a thing. And we all wore bright colours and we chose the music and it was, it's just a funeral, isn't it? I think me and my sister had this mantra, like, this isn't for us, this is for everybody else, and we just have to do it. We've already said our goodbyes to Dad and this isn't for us, this is for everybody else. But I do think it's quite mad that you lose somebody and then you immediately have to, like, plan a party. Like, I think that's a ludicrous thing to have to do. I remember, because there's so much admin, and I remember, like, in the midst of my, like, the first days of grief, being on the phone to this caterer being like, okay, so what canapes do you want? And I was like, what, like, how am I choosing canapes? And, like, do you want Prosecco? And I'm like, I feel like this should be somebody else's job. I feel like culturally we should have it that, like, other people do the funeral for
cousins, like, do funeral, yeah, aunts,
like,
do weddings,
outer circle, yeah, outer, yeah, circle. I was just like, this is a bad cultural thing. I don't like it.
No, I totally understand that, and I think especially in what you guys had been through, because funerals are for other people, definitely, but normally, you know, those other people would have come to the hospital, said goodbye, so you had really been in it completely, like, very intensely, the three of you, for all that time. And then everyone else has been living this completely other narrative of when they last saw him or what they said to him, and you're in completely different places because, you know, you had to kind of go into shutdown with him, didn't you? So completely. that's really tricky, and it's fun that, I mean, again, this is only the hindsight of experience and only my experience. I think when you're in the middle of planning the funeral, it's the worst thing ever. But if you didn't have the funeral, it's like the weird thing of, like, why isn't it outsourced? It's like, because it gives you something to do. something in those those first days when someone's like, do you want canapes? And it gives you something to rage at. Like, fuck you and your fucking canapes. I don't care. But also, well, those ones sound nice. But it gives your brain something to do. And I think there must be some reason culturally that we do end up organising it. Because I think otherwise, if there was nothing, why would you get out of bed? Like, why would you get, why? Like, if you didn't have to answer questions about Prosecco, you just put the duvet over your head and that'd be the end of it for 6 months.
Yeah, this is true. This is true. But for me and for Becky, but mostly me, because I went into like crazed oldest sister mode and just started doing everything immediately. And there was part of me that was like, there was so much to do. Because it all fell to me because dad was single, doesn't have any other kids, like it's my job to do everything, and I was not prepared for the amount of admin that you have to do. It's like nobody warns you about that, like
lot.
I'm not even good at my own life admin, let alone I hate doing my own stuff, let alone
but like you said, especially because he's single and then it's coming to you, and obviously as the oldest I'm sure you feel like it's my responsibility. I can almost hear your little sister being like, I could have done it too, because I'm a little sister, so I know how she feels. But that is a lot, because again, you've really had to shoulder like a large chunk of this in a way that perhaps in other times, I don't know, obviously I don't know your dad's personal circumstances, but like maybe if your mum had come to the hospital more, they could have had that conversation and all of those things. It might have been eased a little bit of like, oh, have you done that by the way? Like, but of course, if you're, like you said, you're 31, like this is not an admin work door you've ever opened. Like, why would you need to? And then you've got, oh my God, bank accounts, password, all that stuff starts kicking off.
Yeah, it was a lot. It was a lot. My mum and sister were amazing and very helpful, I will say on the record. But in those first few days, I was very much like, this is my job. I'm just going to sort everything right now. And I think I've completely gone full circle with that. So now, 9 months on, I'm just like, I don't want to do it anymore. And like, I've very much let my sister take over. And because we're in the process of selling his house. So it's just endless. Like, I just feel like, when will this end? Like, there's always more letters coming through. There's always more things to sort. And it's, you know, it's been 9 months and we're still doing stuff.
I think if somebody's young, it's really tricky. Yeah. We had letters for my dad for fucking years. I'd be like, I'm not joking. Like, my mum got one. It wasn't like last year, but I was like, like something like 5 years ago, so we got one and we were like, what? Like, you know, I think when someone's young, it's trickier that they have more things they're involved with. Like, there's more things they've signed up to and there's more things they've said yes to. And unpicking someone's life who hasn't, because obviously when someone's older, you know, lots of things wrap up naturally, you know, and they don't, you're not, you know, signed up to other newsletters or things, you've just got to like go, what were they doing, what is this? And it's a person's life is a very messy thing, like anybody, you know, we all have so many different bits and pieces that we've read or are signed up to or are thinking about or talking to someone about. And actually it's like you said, that relationship you had with him, that just father daughter, there was a whole other world. So I'm not surprised 9 months on you're still dealing with it.
Plowing through, exactly.
I think once you sell the house, I think hopefully that will reach a kind of a bit of a full stop, because it's like,
I think,
the house breeds the things, doesn't it? So once the house is gone, you can't have the things and all the paperwork in the house because it's not there.
All of the bills and all of that stuff. Yeah, I think that, and that's just the biggest thing. Like, you know, I don't have my own house, let alone selling somebody else's house. I'm just like, I'm not equipped to cope with this. It has been a lot, but
it is a lot. It's a really lot to deal with, especially how have you found, I mean, it's a dumb question, but like, how have you found it? Because so we had, you know, obviously, so he was died in August, things were more relaxed, as we all know. We then moved into trademark the worst winter of everybody's lives. Like, how was it grieving through that while this COVID was still going on and you still couldn't see your friends and you couldn't go to work and be distracted? Like, how has that been managing your grief?
Well, a lot of horrible stuff, a lot of horrible dark times for sure.
Yeah.
I think I've heard people say this on the podcast before about grieving in lockdown, and that initially it's like, oh, great, the world has stopped, good, like it should. Yeah. Like, this is brilliant, like, awesome. And I didn't have to make any excuses. I didn't have to feel guilty about missing out on things. I wanted to hibernate. I got to hibernate.
Yeah.
And that was good. And then it got to a point where I was like, am I just being self-indulgent now? Like, is it time for me to, like, I feel like I would have benefited from some distraction. I think I'm getting to that point now.
Yeah.
Where I'm like, right, I'm ready to be taken out and distracted and have so much fun and have just a bit of a, like, debauched time for just a little while.
Yeah.
My best friend, Donna, her dad passed away in eerily similar circumstances in 2016.
Wow.
And I remember her going through that, and afterwards she just had this, like, wild period, like, after the initial grief. And it was amazing. And, you know, a lot of the nights would end in tears, but at the same time, she was having an amazing time and was just like, well, on the surface, she was just having a very busy time and being very distracted and, like, not caring about anything and just partying for a little while and going on holiday and just, like, living that life that she wanted and felt like she needed after having such a horrible time. And I'm like, I want that now. I want some mad months where I get to be a bit of a mess and everyone's like, oh, that's fine. You know, she's had a hard time. She's allowed to be drunk every weekend for, like, a little while. Like, I want to have a silly time. I want to book holidays with my sister. I want to go to a ridiculous hotel and sip cocktails because, you know, I feel like we can say, oh, we deserve it for, like, a really long time after going through what we did. And there's no option to do that. So I think now I'm just like, I'm sick of this. I'm absolutely sick of it. I need some fun in my life so desperately. And I finally feel ready to do it.
Yeah.
So it's really frustrating to feel like, okay, actually, I could go out and see some stuff. And the world's still like, no, not yet. Not yet. We've all got to pretend to enjoy eating outside at the moment, which is awful.
It's so interesting as someone who hasn't grieved during a pandemic. Because, like you said, people have said on the show, like, they've been denied distraction. They've been absent. And that, again, part of the process. Like, you know, it's just, I keep going back to, like, we're all trying to do our best in this pandemic, but it's not normal. You know, calling it the new normal isn't right because it's not normal. It's not how things work. And the reason things are done like that is because they make sense for humans. And, you know, you're saying about the visitors and all that being on you and the distractions. Like, I've had so many people say, oh, you know, in one way, good. I've had to really face up to it. I couldn't run away from it. In another way, I haven't been able to run away from it. And I think that's so important because you're right. Like, especially when you are a young person grieving, you know, and someone young-ish has died, you kind of do need that moment where you go, oh, fuck it. Sorry, I'm really swearing today. and you do, and you get pissed and you see your friends and you just allow it to not be in your head. And that's, you know, the more I've been reading about grief theory, like, I've talked about it before on the show, like, there's a whole theory, dual process model, where you are meant to have the complete distraction along with the grieving, and that's what allows both to exist. And anything that's two on one side, so obviously if you spend, like, you know, 5 years just partying, I'm sure maybe the grief will need some time as well. But it's just too much on one side, isn't it? It's too insular, too introverted, like, not having that social connection again.
It very much feels like it's too overwhelming at points, and it's like all consuming when I'm not even going to work, I'm not commuting. Like, my life was so busy before, like, normal young person living and working in London. Like, I lived at like 150 miles an hour, and I don't want to go back to that because that was insanely busy, and I was, like, quite glad of turning it down a little bit. But to go from 100 to zero, coupled with the grief and having your whole world just completely flipped and completely everything, all of the truths that I've known in my life this year have just been destroyed. Like, just been like, no, you thought that was true. Actually, it's not. Oh, you thought that this was how life is. Oh, no, but it's not actually. And you have no control over any of it. And it could just keep getting worse. And you think it might, it wouldn't, but actually it might, because this whole sense of like justice and what's fair that we tell ourselves we don't believe, but I think we very much do believe it until it's actually disproven to us. And that has been very much just flipped on its head. I think one thing I've kind of realized from this last year that it's taught me is that, like, I'm very much not the main character. You know how you like move through your life with like protagonist energy and you're like, yes, like I'm the main character, like this is how things go for me. And that's such a privileged position to hold. Like, you know, this belief that if I work hard and I'm nice to people and I do all the right things, everything will generally be mostly okay. Because for 30 years it was like nothing bad happened to me particularly and everything was fine. And then out of the blue, my dad died and there's a pandemic for kind of no reason. Like there's no like logical reason for either of those things to happen, but they have. And it's just made me think, oh, like, okay, like I am not untouchable. My family is not untouchable. And I think I feel like it sounds so childish to even like maintain that idea, but I think there was a part of me that really truly believed that that wouldn't happen to us, like not us, like obviously not.
I don't think it's childish, because I think, like you said, what you said it a couple of seconds ago, like until it's disproved to you. And I think that is, unfortunately, I wish humans were cleverer. we're not like you. It's like you have to put your hand in the fire before you go, oh, that burns, and people can tell you, and you can be like, yeah that sounds hot, yeah, totally. But somewhere in your brain you're like, maybe not me. And I don't think it's childish, or it's just like the way we work. It's how we survive, you know. It's how we cross the road. Because if you thought about it too much, as grief makes you do, you sort of freeze for a bit. And I can definitely relate to that, except, you know, I had that experience at 15 of being like, oh, I see. Nothing is safe. Right. Okay. Yeah. Like, it's really... And of course, if it hasn't been disproved to you and your dad is fit and healthy and you, you know, and we all sort of have this kind of there, but for the grace of God, go I, you know. So you, in a way, that's probably the wrong phrase, but what I mean is that when you hear about other people's stories, oh, that's sad, gosh, but not us, we're okay.
Yeah.
Like, oh, they smoked, or they weren't healthy, or they did this thing that made them vulnerable. We don't do that. And you just, but of course you do, because if you really accepted how chaotic the world was, I mean, you just, like I said, you wouldn't move. You just stand still being like, ah. So I think we build up this like fake idea of control. And that's what I think has been interesting this past year. Everybody has experienced loss of control, and that's been very destabilizing for everyone. But to have that plus grief, that is like a double dose of, by the way, everything's insane and you're just on a rock that's spinning through space. Like,
oh my gosh, honestly, that loss of control has been so wildly just destabilizing is the word I keep coming back to, because I honestly feel like the foundations of everything that I know are just crumbling around me, and I'm like desperately trying to grab onto something, like,
clinging,
please, something, stay still, and it just isn't. But I think there's been there's kind of a duality in that loss of control, and I really feel it, and I flip wildly between the two at the moment. I'm hoping I like settle at some point, because like it, on one hand, that complete loss of control and, you know, stability has made me feel like nothing is important. Nothing matters. What is the point? Like, you can't do anything anyway. Be a good person. Be a bad person. Be healthy. Don't be healthy. Literally doesn't matter.
Yep.
Look at your silly little hopes and dreams. Look at your silly little career plan that you're trying to do. Like, it doesn't matter. You're an idiot. It doesn't matter. And like, part of me has become very nihilistic and it's just like, literally fuck it all, like it doesn't matter, clearly. But then on the flip side of that, I'm like, everything now matters so intensely. And I don't know how I'm holding both of those at the same time, but like tiny little moments I'm like, oh, this is a deep moment, I have to feel it. And like everything's become heightened as well. And I have this kind of this weird morbid like deep thankfulness, and like I've started doing this weird thing in my mind where like when things are just normal, or like I'm just having a pleasant, not awful time, I'm like, in my brain, I'm like, these are the good times. Don't forget. These are the good times. Because that's I've seen how bad it can be.
That's so... I was just laughing because I was just like, yeah, then welcome to my world. That's just like... that's just grief. But I am someone who like got stuck in grief for a long time. So don't...
Yeah.
Don't worry. Like, I think you won't be like this. Because I do think when it happens to you so young, something goes odd in your head. But yeah, I completely understand that. Part of you is like... literally nothing matters, like everything is just this pathetic attempt to try and not die, and we're all gonna die anyway. And then the other part of you is like, you're saying goodbye to a friend, you're like, they could die and they're special, goodbye friend, and they're like looking at you like, all right, Jesus Christ. I like, I am such an intense person because of that. And and I think a lot of grief is duality. That's what I've really got my head around, especially this past year. A lot of grief is absolutely just two things at the same time, which again, humans don't like. We don't like it. We want it to be simple. And it's like, no, it's really not. Like we were saying that, you know, that balance of when someone dies from terminal illness, you know, there's this sort of duality of, well, I got to say goodbye to them, but I had to watch them in pain. And now, like, I know that nothing matters, but I now know that everything matters. And like, actually, that sort of grief and sort of... without sounding like a total wanker, it's sort of the answer to life. Like, that is the truth. That is the truth of it. And unfortunately, I do think when we talk about someone being in the club or someone gets it, all we mean is people not in the club, inverted commas, still think they have control. That's what I think. When I talk to them and they look at me like, yeah, but that happened to your dad, not my dad, or I wouldn't do that because of this, and you think, yeah, you still think there's some like logic to this. And there isn't. There's nothing. There's no logic. There's just absolutely no logic to it. And that's, it's taken me a long time. But I do feel more peaceful with that. But it's still hard. And I think it's hard when you're obviously very close to him. He was obviously a great dad. And he obviously, you know, he really loved you. And you obviously really loved him. And that's hard to go, then why did that end? Like, that's hard. It's a really hard thing to carry around when... Because obviously it's hard. Sometimes people have like, well, I don't know they love me, and I have all that complications. But it's also hard. It's still hard when you're like, yeah, I knew I was loved. So why did that go away?
100%. 100%. And that's again the duality of it as well. And that feeling of that you're so thankful for all that love, and I'm so grateful that we had such an amazing relationship. Like it was a rare thing. Like, genuinely think that, and I'm so happy that I got to have that. But at the same time, that makes it even worse that it's gone. Yeah. I'm like, why the hell? Like, that's not fair. And it's like, the more the love, the bigger the price that you pay. Yeah. And that just feels like, oh, it's a horrible fact of being a human, I think. And that's something I've learned as well. And like, sometimes, like, I've been with my boyfriend a long time, and like, I love him a lot. And like, sometimes I look at him like, oh my God, I'm so scared that I love you this much. Like, this is, and now I'm like, oh God, it's so scary loving people. Like, it's scary. And I think I used to feel completely secure in loving people, and that they would all just be eternal for me for somehow. And now I'm like, oh, the more I love you, the harder this will be. Or which is so morbid.
It is, but you are right in the middle of a very morbid situation. Yeah. So I think that's the thing to remember. Like, you know, you haven't even had your first anniversary. Like, I'm not a good person to talk to because I still have those thoughts. Me and my husband been together a very long time, and he had his first injection yesterday, and the whole morning I was like, what if he dies? 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 And then he texts me like, oh, done, you know, just wait, having my weight. And I was like, literally went, oh, and I was like, God, you spent the whole morning thinking he was going to die, the whole fucking morning. And I was like, oh, yeah, like, I'm just used to myself now. But it you know, it's hard not to be morbid when something morbid has happened to you. And I don't think you should, I'm not saying that you are, but like, you know, don't be hard on yourself. Like, especially when you've been up against, this is like, again, I mix my metaphors all the time, but you've been like up in the coal fire, you know, like you said those, I thought it was really interesting when you said, oh, it's 3 weeks I've like walled them up. And that was a really intense, traumatic experience. And we can say nice things about it, and we can say like, oh, it's good you were there and all that, but it doesn't take, the duality is that was also really horrible. And you know, of course those things weigh on your mind, and of course they bleed out into other things and worrying about it and worrying about other people, and that's just, it's such a natural part of it. And I don't know, I don't have a point, just that it's fine that you feel that way.
Yeah,
I think it's,
well,
okay.
That's a good enough point. Yeah.
And I guess also the other thing I guess we should talk about is, you know, you've had a book come out and he's not been there. And that must have been a really, like, I guess, is that the first big thing that's happened in terms of like things that he would have been at and would have been proud of and all of that sort of thing?
Absolutely. And I was kind of dreading it. And I was writing the book before he got sick, because obviously it was a very short period. Thankfully, he read all of the bits of the book that I needed him to read, because there's the stuff about him and his family and us as a family in there, and I needed him to read it.
Yeah, that's good.
And he did.
So that was
really good. But I was so worried about the launch, and it's made me realise how much of my motivation was impressing him and getting his approval. It kind of means more to me than anything else, which is quite like a hard pill to swallow, because I think I like to think I'm out here doing this for me, and I am in a way.
Yeah.
But wow, I needed that approval. Wow, yeah. I love that approval. Oh my God. Getting a text from Dad saying, oh, that was great, babe. Oh, love that article, babe. That's really good. I'd be like, oh yes, like that was like my crack. Like I didn't realize now. Yeah. And now I'm like, oh, I don't know, like, and you know, he was a journalist and I'm a journalist. And I'm like, okay, this is what I'm trying to impress him. Like, and so now that he's not here, I'm like, what am I doing this for? What's this silly little like writing career for then, if it's not to show him and to get him to be like, oh yeah, you're mint. Like that's all I wanted. So that was very, I'm very proud of myself for finishing it.
God, yeah.
Because I finished it in the very, you know, immediate aftermath of him dying.
Wow,
like,
bloody hell.
Because I was close to finishing. I was writing the final chapter, which is ironic, isn't it? as he was kind of in the hospice and trying to do my job and kind of write this book and care for my dad and be with him. And I spoke to my editor like a few days after he died, and she was like, amazing. My editor's amazing. And was just like, take whatever time you need. Like this does not matter in comparison to what you're going through. Be with your family. And I did do that, and I was with my family, but very soon afterwards, I was like, I need to finish this book. And it was like, and almost like in terms of, you know, you said about how the funeral gets people through, finishing that was what got me through, and having a reason to get up and to do something, because he knew I'd started it. He knew I was doing it. He'd seen the front cover. He knew it was happening. He knew when it was coming out, and he was absolutely buzzing about it. Like, he told everybody about it all the time. Everyone at his work knew about it. And like, he was so proud and excited, and I was just like, I have to finish it for him. Like, I just have to.
You should be very proud of yourself for doing that after then. Like, definitely. Yeah. And I completely understand that drive that it must have given you as well. But equally, the fact that you did it is incredible. That really is incredible.
Thank you. Yeah. And I was worried about the actual launch. Mm. And I thought, how am I going to enjoy this or celebrate it, or all these things, like the process of the book writing was 2 years.
Yeah.
And now all of a sudden I was like, well, I don't want to do it. I don't want it to be on. I can't be excited about anything right now. Yeah. Like, I don't want to be happy about anything. I can't be like patting myself on the back and like drinking champagne. Like, I can't do that. But actually, it's been great. And I have felt excited, and I've been really happy to know that I can feel that and that I can still have that spark of, oh, I am excited about, I feel passionate about something that I'm doing. And that's been like an incredibly encouraging feeling to know that that's still in there. Because I think at the beginning, you think that part of you has like died.
Yeah.
And I was like, I'm never going to be happy. I'm never going to be excited. Nothing in my life is going to feel good again. Like, it does feel like that. So to feel that like spark of like, oh, I'm excited to have a book out. Like, yeah, that's great. And the launch was amazing, as I said. Like, I felt a lot of love, and it was weird because I'm not a spiritual kind of person at all, and a non-religious, but I didn't feel like he wasn't there for it. I was like, I don't actually feel like he's missed it. And I don't know how I've managed to create that feeling within myself. But I'm very happy that I have, because yeah. I was very worried that I was going to be like, oh my God, he's not going to see it, whatever that means. But I didn't feel that. I was like, I don't know. I just had this like very deep sense of he knows, like he absolutely knows. He like, I think because he like poured so much pride and love into me and my sister throughout our lives, like I don't think we are ever going to be lacking, or I think he like gave us enough to get us through, if that makes sense. Yeah, so I'm gonna cry now. But yeah, I think he basically gave us enough love that I'm never gonna feel like, oh, I'm missing that pride or love from him, because he gave us an abundance. I think we've got enough to get us through, essentially.
That's really amazing. That's really, really amazing. And what a nice way to put it. I've said that before in the show, that as a parent, you know, what I've learned from being a parent and from losing a parent, like, yeah, all you can do is love them so hard that when you're gone, they still feel it.
Yeah.
And what you just said, like, I think that's so interesting, because, yeah, not being spiritual, not being religious, but looking in yourself and being like, oh, there it is. Like, I know that he would be proud. Even though he's not here, I know. And I know he's here. Like, that's just, yeah, I just think that's a testament to, like, what a great dad he was. He sounds like such a good dad, like a really good dad to have.
Yeah.
Two kids that love him that much, that he just loved so much. And it's a long game, parenting. It's a really long game, you know? Like, there's definitely days where you're like, what is this about? Why is this like, they seem to just ignore everything I say and throw food at me. And yeah, for that to, you know, I think that's a really beautiful thing, Natalie, really beautiful. Thank you so much for talking to me about Tony. He sounds bloody brilliant. What a legend.
Yeah.
And I feel like we should all maybe have a vodka and coke now to like have a little.
Absolutely.
Little. I don't know if he'd approve of the vodka and coke or what he'd prefer, but yeah, that's what it feels like.
He would have a neat vodka straight from the freezer.
Oh.
Yeah, he was hardcore.
That's
was
hardcore. Oh god.
Very hardcore.
Ice in there, just straight from the freezer.
Sometimes ice.
Oh yeah. Depends. He's
hardcore though.
He put more time in than I had. Yeah, that's fair. I'll do it. We'll still raise it. We'll raise the imagine. Well, Natalie, thank you so much for talking to me. I really, really appreciate it. Natalie's book, Mixed Other, is available to buy now, and you can also follow her on Twitter at NMOZZ. You can follow us on Twitter and Instagram at The Griefcast. The show was recorded remotely, I think from both our living rooms, and edited by Kate Holland. The music was provided by The Glue Ensemble. And remember, you are not alone.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.